Penguin Random House Audio proudly presents The 1619 Project, a new origin story. Created by Nicole Hannah-Jones and the New York Times Magazine. Edited by Nicole Hannah-Jones, Caitlin Roper, Elena Silverman, and Jake Silverstein. Read for you by Nicole Hannah-Jones and a full cast.
To the more than 30 million descendants of American slavery. The poetry and fiction that appears between the nonfiction chapters of this book occurs on a timeline that runs chronologically from 1619 to the present. While the nonfiction chapters are not strictly chronological, they have been arranged with the historical narrative in mind. A note about this book. This book uses a variety of terms to describe the aspects of the era of slavery. In almost every case, the editors have avoided the word slave to describe persons held in bondage. The alternate term, enslaved person, accurately conveys the condition without stripping the individual of his or her humanity. In some instances where it does not refer to a person, example, slave state, and in some of the historical poetry and fiction, slave does appear. The editors have attempted to limit the use of terms that are sometimes used euphemistically, such as plantation or master, or to substitute, when possible, other terms that more accurately convey the historical situation of enslavement. As this book contains the work of many different authors, some of them representing different scholarly fields, there remains some heterogeneity in how these terms are deployed. The editors. I am the American heartbreak, the rock on which freedom stumped its toe, the great mistake that Jamestown made long ago. Langston Hughes, American Heartbreak, 1619. Preface. Origins by Nicole Hannah-Jones. I was maybe 15 or 16 when I first came across the date 1619. Whenever I think about that moment, my mind conjures an image of glowing three-dimensional numbers rising from the page. Of course, in reality, they were printed in plain black text on the cheap page of a paperback. Still, while the numbers did not literally glow, I remember sitting back in my chair and staring at the date, a bit confused, thrown off kilter by an exhilarating revelation starting to sink in. For as long as I can remember, I've been fascinated with the past. Even as a young girl, I loved watching documentaries and feature films about events that took place in a bygone era. As a middle school student, I read all of my dad's Louis L'Amour westerns and the entire Little House series because they transported me to this mythic American frontier. I loved sitting in my grandparents' basement, leafing through aged photo albums filled with square black and white images and asking questions about the long-dead relatives frozen in the frame. My favorite subjects in school were English and social studies, and I peppered my teachers with questions. History revealed the building blocks of the world I now inhabited, explaining how communities, institutions, relationships came to be. Learning history made the world make sense. It provided the key to decode all that I saw around me. Black people, however, were largely absent from the histories I read. The vision of the past I absorbed from school textbooks, television, and the local history museum depicted a world, perhaps a wishful one, where Black people did not really exist. This history rendered Black Americans, Black people on all the earth, inconsequential at best, invisible at worst. We appeared only where unavoidable. Slavery was mentioned briefly in the chapter on this nation's most deadly war, and then black people disappeared again for a full century until magically reappearing as Martin Luther King Jr. gave a speech about a dream. This quantum leap served to wrap the black experience up in a few paragraphs and a tidy bow, never really explaining why, 100 years after the abolition of slavery, King had to lead the March on Washington in the first place. We were not actors, but acted upon. We were not contributors, just recipients. White people enslaved us, and white people freed us. Black people could either choose to take advantage of that freedom or to squander it, as our depictions in the media seem to suggest so many of us were doing. The world revealed to me through my education was a white one. And yet, my intimate world, my neighborhood, the friends I rode the bus with for 2 hours each day to and from the schools on the white side of town, the boisterous bevy of aunts, uncles, and cousins who crowded our home for barbecues and card games, was largely black. At school, I searched desperately to find myself in the American story we were taught, to see my humanity, our humanity, reflected back to me. I snatched Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry from our elementary school library shelf because it was the one book with a black girl on the cover. In high school, when my advanced placement English teacher assigned us a final project on a famous American literary figure, I wrote about the only black poet I had been exposed to, Langston Hughes. My public high school in Waterloo, Iowa, offered a one-semester elective called The African American Experience, which I took my sophomore year. Only other black kids filled the seats each day, and the only black male teacher I'd ever have taught the course. Rail thin and mahogany-skinned, with a booming laugh that revealed the wide gap between his front teeth, Mr. Ray Dow deftly navigated our class through the ancient Mali, Songhai, Nubian, and Ghana empires. It was he who taught me that, from here to Timbuktu, referred to an African center of learning. Surveying the cultures and knowledge and civilizations that existed among African peoples long before Europeans decided that millions of human beings could be forced across the ocean in the hulls of ships and then redefined as property. He taught us about Richard Allen founding the first independent black denomination on this soil, and how hard enslaved people fought for the legal right to do things every other race took for granted, such as reading or marrying or keeping your own children. He taught us about black resistance and black writers. He taught us about Martin, but also Marcus and Malcolm and Mamie and Fanny. Sitting in that class each day, I felt as if I had spent my entire life struggling to breathe and someone had finally provided me with oxygen. I feel a pang of embarrassment now when I recall my surprise that so many books existed about black people and by black people, that black people had so much history that could be learned. I felt at once angry and empowered, and these dueling emotions drove an appetite for learning black American history that has never left me. I began asking Mr. Dial for books to read beyond the assigned texts, devouring them, and then asking for others. "Dr. Hannah," he exclaimed one day, flashing his trademark toothy grin as he put a book in my hands, Before the Mayflower, by the historian and journalist Lerone Bennett, Jr. As soon as I got home that afternoon, I sat down at our dining room table and pulled it from my book bag. A few dozen pages in, I read these words. "She came out of a violent storm with a story no one believed. A year before the arrival of the celebrated Mayflower, 113 years before the birth of George Washington, 244 years before the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, this ship sailed into the harbor at Jamestown, Virginia, and dropped anchor into the muddy waters of history. It was clear to the men who received this Dutch man of war that she was no ordinary vessel. What seems unusual today is that no one sensed how extraordinary she really was, for few ships, before or since, have unloaded a more momentous..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?